This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Stephanie Chasen about her book titled British Jews and Imperial Service, Nationalism, Pan-Islamism and Zionism in Mandate Palestine and Colonial India, published by Bloomsbury. This book is really interesting, taking us right back to the end of the devastating World War I to understand three very important people who had some very important jobs in the British colonial empire at the time and who were Jewish. And the book investigates kind of how all these things come together, what this meant for them, what this meant for everyone around them, and lots more. So, Stephanie, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to tell us about your book.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Yes. Well, I received my doctorate in 2008 at UCLA. And after getting the doctorate, I did some teaching. Primarily, my doctorate is in Jewish history and modern European, but I taught Jewish history for the most part from ancient to modern day. Soon found out that teaching wasn't actually for me, but I did really like research and writing even more. So I started doing research for various people and some editing, and in the meantime, started writing a book which would be published with the title Anti-Capitalism and the Emergence of Anti-Semitism, which looked at the connection between economics and anti-Semitism as we know it. So after that was published, I began to wonder, you know, what am I going to write on next? And I decided to revisit my dissertation, which had been called Citizens of Empire. And it looked at Jews who held positions in the British Empire at the beginning of the 20th century. And it was very far-flung. It looked at people in Australia and Nigeria and South Africa. And it was a bit unwieldy, as I think many dissertations are. But what struck me when I reread it was were these three men who, after World War I, were ruling the most important part of the British Empire, that is India, and also the newly mandated Palestine. And the fact that these three men were Jewish, I thought was very intriguing at a time when a lot of historians had told us that this was a time of overwhelming anti-Semitism and that this was increasing. So it just intrigued me why, how they could achieve this kind of position. So I decided to go back and heavily rewrite the dissertation, focusing on these three men and what this could tell us a larger question about Jews in the British Empire, but also it focused on these questions that are still with us today about nationalism, about pan-Islamism, and about Zionism, and how they all came together and how they involved these three men in particular. So that's basically how I came about to write this book. It's really a rehash of my dissertation, but a very, very slimmed down version.
Thank you for that introduction. Always fascinating to hear kind of how people come in or back in to projects. Given especially what you were speaking to right at the end of that about kind of how many questions this content still very much speaks to, why do you think this history hasn't been previously told?
I think there are several reasons for that. And it has been noted by various scholars of Jewish British history that it is a touchy subject. I think, first of all, increasingly colonial history has become one that is difficult to talk about without it being either a history of the oppressor and the oppressed, one of quite frequently racism and violence. They're things that tend to be spoken of when you think of colonial history now. So I think a lot of Jewish historians tend to want to look at Jewish history as Jews being on the side of the oppressed rather than what they might see as the oppressor, especially post-Holocaust, of course. So I think there's a disinclination to look at Jews in power. There have been some books on Jews in power, a few of them, but they don't really look at these kind of men, the men of the establishment, men who are carrying out British policy in the biggest empire, obviously. So I think they are reluctant to look at Jews in power, and especially colonial power. Partly that may be due also to accusations that we hear frequently, and especially today, of Jewish colonization of Palestine. So I think for all these reasons, it tends to be a subject they want to shy away from, and they want to show Jews as being the outsider rather than the insider. Certainly when I was in graduate school, the Jew as other was a very common trope. They were the perennial outsider. So I think this goes against what a lot of Jewish historians would like to present. Now, of course, this all suggests that there's one particular Jewish collective, which is something that I would argue against, and I have in my book. But I think this is for that reason. There is also, amongst some historians of British Jewish history, a desire to look for what they might call and what they have termed as an authentic Jew. And those authentic Jews don't tend to be the kind of men that appear in this book. For them, these men would be the most inauthentic, the authentic being the ones who, again, tend to be the outsiders, tend to be the revolutionaries, tend to be the poorer Jews, the people who came from Eastern Europe, who were the immigrants into the countries. And so for a lot of reasons, I think these kind of men would be dismissed and not thought of as suitable subjects. And, you know, there is something to be said about it is a difficult subject when you put Jews in colonial history, particularly nowadays. But I think it is a very interesting history. And I think because it hasn't been told very often, I think it's worthy of being told.
Well, so let's get in then to telling us about this history. You've spoken a bit about kind of these men and how they might be viewed. Can you introduce us to the three people at the heart of the book and tell us a little bit about their backgrounds?
Certainly. Okay, three men are Rufus Isaacs, who became known as Lord Reading, Herbert Samuel, probably the best known, and Edwin Montagu, who happened to be his cousin. So I'll give you a bit of background about each of them in turn, and I'll go from according to age. So we'll start with Rufus Isaacs, who was born in London, in Tower Hamlets, into a very middle-class family. His father was actually a fruit importer in Spitalfields in London. And Rufus was expected to go into the family business. That was what was his life was supposed to be. But this didn't really enthuse him very much. So he started to have various adventures, one being running off as a ship's boy to Brazil, which didn't satisfy him either. But it was his first time that he visited India. And there was an apocryphal story that goes around that as he was leaving, this young boy said, oh, you know, I will return, but I will return as viceroy. Well, he didn't actually say that at the time, but it's a nice story. So when he gets back to London, he starts a career as a jobber in stock market, stock exchange, where he runs up huge debts. And this speaks something to his personality. There's a certain recklessness in his personality, which he then stymies. And he has this almost like a determination to become much more cautious, much more serious. And so he trains to be a lawyer and is called to the bar around 1885. And he's very, very successful. And within a short time, he's paid off his debts and he's become Queen's Counsel. And he has cultivated this very analytical style. Very studied, very thoughtful, and this will be the kind of style he'll take into his political career. He does become the Liberal MP for Reading in 1904, and by 1910, he's Attorney General. He's the first Attorney General to sit in the cabinet. In 1913, he's the Lord Chief Justice, and during the war, he becomes the British ambassador to the US while still retaining the post of Lord Chief Justice. And he's by now Viscount Reading. So he's come a long way. And of course, the part that is the most interesting for this book, the point of this book is by 1921, he's made the Viceroy of India and becomes the Marquess of Reading at that point. So we have this incredible rise from the son of a fruit importer to becoming the most important man in Indian politics. Herbert Samuel has a very different life, a much more privileged one, wealthier. He's born in Liverpool. He comes from a family that is more modest. You know, his great-grandfather was from a place near Posen and emigrated to England. But he was, by now his family were wealthier and he was educated at Balliol. And it was at Balliol that he gave up his religious belief. And it's not an uncommon thing to do. He's fascinated by other forms such as Fabianism, which he takes up. So he writes to his mother and tells her, you know, I no longer believe in these things, don't have any religious belief anymore. And of course, this sends Clara Samuel into a state. So he decides in the end he will compromise. He keeps up Jewish tradition. He keeps being part of the Jewish community and observing certain things such as Sabbath and dietary laws and things like that. But his passion will be ignited later by something else rather than religion. He becomes Liberal MP for Cleveland in 1902 and has various posts along the way. 1916, during the war, he's Home Secretary. And it's during this period that his passion is ignited by Zionism. And he becomes close to Chaim Weizmann and various other people. And he sees it as a mission to try and encourage other members of the British government to also endorse Zionism and see Palestine as a place that would be strategically important for the British Empire. And once it was under the control, given obviously if the British win the war, once it becomes under the control of the British, then they would foster Jewish immigration into Palestine and some kind of Jewish homeland, some kind of state of some sort. So he spends a lot of time at this period trying to convince others, including the Prime Minister, Asquith, who is not convinced. But by the end of 1916, there's been a change. And so David Lloyd George replaces Asquith. And David Lloyd George is much more open to the idea of Zionism for more religious reasons. And so this is another aspect that Herbert Samuel will also try to convince people that it will add luster to the British crown to have Palestine, because, and it will be, you know, almost a biblical revelation for them. So for those reasons, he is chosen by David Lloyd George after the war to become the first High Commissioner. Once Britain has, and its allies have won the war, and once they have got a mandate over Palestine, he chooses Herbert Samuel to be the first High Commissioner, and as was, you know, that will be controversial. The third person is Samuel's cousin, Edwin Montagu, and like Samuel, he grows up. His life is actually even more privileged than Samuel, because his father was Baron Swathling, Samuel Montagu, who was also an MP until 1900, extremely wealthy because he owned the Samuel Montagu Bank. And his father, Samuel, was a committed Orthodox Jew. But like his cousin, Herbert, while Edwin Montagu was at Trinity College, Cambridge, he also lost his religious sensibility. He was no longer interested in it and wrote to his father, again, obviously causing a lot of distress. He wrote to his father saying that he will always be a good Jew, but according to his own ideals rather than his father's. His father responds by changing his will and making sure that if Edwin was to marry somebody who was not Jewish, that he would be cut out of the will. So Edwin goes into law like Rufus Isaacs, but unlike Rufus Isaacs, who really enjoyed the law, he absolutely detests it and decides he'll follow his father and go into politics. And Edwin is a very different character to Herbert. Herbert Samuel is rather staid. Some call him prudish. He's a very moral-minded man. On the other hand, Edwin Montagu tends to be much more charismatic. Perhaps nowadays might call him a bit manic depressive, very thin-skinned, very rash. But he's also a great host and has a lot of very loyal friends. So he has a much more perhaps, I wouldn't say unstable, but certainly a more vivacious personality, if we can say that. So he becomes MP for Chesterton, which is part of Cambridgeshire, in 1906, when the election brings the Liberals into power. And he begins his ascent also up the greasy pole. And in 1910 until 1914, he becomes the Under Secretary of State for India. And this is when he takes his first trip to India and falls in love with the country and falls in love with Indian politics. And this is the only thing he wants to do. That lasts until 1914 with the war, and he becomes financial secretary to the Treasury. He's the Minister of Munitions. And then in 1917, after the debacle in Mesopotamia, the Mesopotamian campaign, Austen Chamberlain resigns his position as Secretary of State for India. And David Lloyd George chooses Montagu with his wealth of knowledge of India to become the Secretary of State. And this is something he's just dreamed of. So they're the three men, and that's how they get to the positions that are the focus of the book.
Mm.
Thank you for that introduction, not just about kind of what their title is, but helping us understand sort of how they got there and in some senses kind of what it means to them to have these positions. And it's that piece I'd like to kind of poke a bit more at. Obviously, these positions are very much within the center of politics in a lot of ways. There's a lot of strands to politics, domestic, imperial, all sort of woven together. How did they think about sort of imperialism and the British Empire being so much at the heart of it?
Well, all three were liberal imperialists. The Liberal Party was quite a wide camp, and so there were people who were not enamored with imperialism, had various reasons for thinking it was not a good idea to keep adding other lands to the empire. But these three were committed liberal imperialists. And what that meant for them was an idea that the empire could be, in fact, Samuel used this term, it could have a nobility of purpose. It could be a force for good. So it didn't equate to might is right. It wasn't a Disraelian idea that, you know, it was just something of splendor. But it actually could improve the lives of the people they ruled over. It could provide material wealth, intellectual wealth, maybe cultural wealth. So the empire itself, in and of itself, was not either good or bad. It was only because it obviously had advantages, it had disadvantages. But if you had the right kind of imperialism, they would argue, as they did, and Herbert Samuel actually wrote a book on liberal imperialism. If you had their idea of what the right kind of imperialism is, then they really believed that the colonies were better off under British rule than as independent states. So the empire, in their minds, the empire should defend, obviously, and promote British interests, but it shouldn't do so at the expense of the population. So it shouldn't do something that would harm the population. They believed it could develop commerce, and this would also be helpful. And it could really improve the well-being of the subjects. And part of this also feeds into racialist ideas that, you know, these countries were somewhat barbaric. And they used these terms. And they thought that, oh, the British Empire will come along and it will be rational and it will defeat these countries that have dynastic wars, that are superstitious, that are ruled by tyrants who just plunder. It will get rid of cruel traditions, slavery, and all kinds of things that are terrible. So in their minds, the British Empire was some vehicle to bring such things as literacy, education, commerce, trade. It could bring justice. I mean, that was one of the major things, that it would bring the rule of law to countries that were lawless, in their opinion, by bringing not only the judges and the certain rules and regulations, but policing, so you'd protect people's life and property. And it would also bring hospitals, medical schools, and infrastructure. So, and they did do a lot of that during their time there, building roads and railways and irrigations and irrigation systems and various things. So for all these reasons, these liberal imperialists that, and Montagu, Reading, and Samuel, as liberal imperialists, believed that it was a way to bring humanity into certain parts of the world and make it better. So it's a very paternalistic view, stemming from obviously classic liberal ideas. So I think that you also, though, have to read when they say, like, backwards, these are backward places. They all tend to use that language. Montagu has use the term savages to talk about some people, not the educated Indian elite, but he might refer to other Indians as savages. Rufus Isaac at one point is appalled that somebody who is an English woman is going to marry somebody who is an Indian man, things like this. So they hold those views, which of course are very common at the time, but they genuinely believed that the British Empire could be a force for good and it would be better for the people living under it.
So now that you've framed sort of that side of the debate and their position in it, can you add a different view of how the world could work? How did the issue of pan-Islamism link different parts of the British Empire, especially that the three of them are involved with? And how did this influence these debates about British imperialism?
Well, pan-Islamism, which begins way before, but with regard to this book, refers to the Khilafat movement. It had the idea that rather than belonging to the Muslim League, which had been formed in response to the Indian Congress, that Muslims, regardless of their home nation, should be linked to a more expansive political group that was based on their religion and not based on their territory. So many Muslims in India began to be enticed by the Khilafat movement that started, it started during the war, but it really gained steam after the war. And for them, the Sultan, being the Caliph, as well as the territorial head, was vital for the Khilafat. It wasn't necessarily the case for all pan-Islamists. In fact, Al-Afghani, who was one of the foremost proponents of pan-Islamism, didn't think the Caliph was that important for it. But for the Indian Caliphate movement, the Sultan and support of the Ottoman Empire was vital, and as well as the holy sites, Mecca, Medina, and Jerusalem. So I think it was built on this stimulus for religious and intellectual revitalization. Again, a movement that had been going on since the 19th century. So this was their way of revitalizing what they believed. The religion had become too full of Western currents, too full of political ideas, intellectual ideas, cultural ideas that were tainted by the West. So this was their way to try and revitalize it. And concerns about pan-Islamism and the British Empire do stretch back to Victoria's reign. And then they continue. And there's a lot of articles, there's a lot of discussion about whether or not it should be taken seriously, whether or not it was a danger to the British Empire. Some people raised concerns. Some people were alarmist that this is the most urgent thing, we need to take care of it. And some were dismissive. For example, Mark Sykes, who will become well-known during the war in this area, he thought it was unlikely that Muslims would rise up if anything happened to the Ottoman Empire after the war was over. So if all of a sudden someone decided to dismantle it completely, he didn't think that Muslims in India were that concerned about it. But others had a different view and thought that, yes, if somebody declares a jihad, that Muslims who are committed to pan-Islamism are going to listen to that and not, obviously, these foreign rulers. So the Khilafat movement in India takes up the cause of Turkey and takes up the cause of the Sultan. And they do this even before the war. They do it during the Balkan Wars. It wasn't quite common to see the pictures of the Turkish leaders on the walls of Indian pan-Islamists. So The Ottoman Empire really does become the burning issue for men such as the Ali brothers, Muhammad and Shaukat Ali, who are two of the leaders of the Khilafat movement. So what was the last part of your question? I've forgotten the last part.
That's fabulous. I guess now that you've set that up, how does that then relate to the debates about British imperialism and liberal imperialism?
It relates to that in the sense of the British have to decide during the war that if they are successful, if they are going to win the war, what is going to become of the Ottoman Empire, who has fought against them, obviously, and what should become of the Sultan. And so their main concern, though, also, is that they have an awful lot of Muslims under their rule. So they are very, very concerned that whatever they do doesn't cause a massive revolt or something that would lead, some people believe, to the end of the empire. So their concern then is, what's the best policy to have to enact so that we can not disturb Muslims living under the British rule to the point that they will want to revolt, but will also deal with certain issues that are going on. And so for that reason, a lot of treaties were made during the war, which complicate this issue tremendously. You have, for example, the first one that of some consequence happens in 1915, and Henry McMahon has some very vague discussions with Sheikh Hussein of the Hejaz. And he says, well, in return for your support during the war against the Ottomans, in return for Arab support, and a revolt against the Ottomans, we'll give you material and we'll give you gold and we'll give you all these things, but we will also promise that you will be independent. You will have some kind of Arab state with a true Arab at the head, which of course Hussein takes to be him. And this land obviously is thought to go from Syria all the way down to Palestine. So that's one way it starts to complicate the situation, because now you've brought in Arab nationalism into the whole picture, because Arabs now are beginning to get the idea that, well, if everybody's talking about having a land of their own and this, that, and the other, maybe we should have it too, and we should not be ruled by the Ottomans. So if the British are going to win and this is going to be a free country, then, you know, this is what we would like. This further complicated by the Sykes-Picot agreement in 1915, 1916, which was very secret. This was not known until after the war. And that's Mark Sykes, the British diplomat, and François Picot, along with Russia, come up with a policy that would carve up the Ottoman Empire post-war, obviously assuming victory, and it will divide it into zones. So France will get Syria, and they'll get Turkey, and they'll get Lebanon and Iraq, and Britain will get Jordan and Iraq, southern Iraq, France will get northern Iraq, and they'll get Palestine. And then Russia will get Constantinople, something it's been after for a long time. So that complicates the first one, because obviously Hussein is under the impression that he is going to be in Syria, and now this is going to be ceded to the French. And this all goes against, obviously, the pan-Islamic ideal, which will keep the Ottoman Empire and the Sultan intact. So we have a further complication, and that is in 1917, for many reasons, the British decide to write a very short letter to Lord Rothschild. And this Balfour Declaration has caused probably a disproportionate amount of confusion considering the shortness of it. I mean, it's two paragraphs, and yet nobody could quite agree what those two paragraphs meant. So this added another complication, because it was now saying that the British would support a Jewish homeland, not the Jewish homeland as Chaim Weizmann wanted them to put in, but a Jewish homeland. But it was not to be done at the expense of the population already living there. That's the Palestinian Arab population. So this again adds a further cog in the wheel that you have now a decision that if the British have Palestine, that they are going to approve Jewish immigration, something the Ottomans had tried to prevent into Palestine and form some kind of homeland there. So again, it goes against everything, including the pan-Islamic ideal, which is, of course, just to keep the Ottomans. So because of these, this will ignite the Khilafat movement in India even more. And not just the Khilafat movement, because this is not just a concern now for the Khilafats. This is also a concern for other Muslims in India, even those who do not want to belong to a caliphate. They are objecting to the fact that Jews from Eastern Europe are going to be allowed to come into Palestine and turn it into a Jewish state, as they say, as they talk about. So you have that. Then there are two more, which I'll quickly just mention. In 1918, the French and the English have a declaration. And in this, they talk about that there will be the complete and final liberation of the people oppressed by the Turks. So this obviously gives hope to Arabs thinking again. This kind of goes back to the Hussein and McMahon discussion, but that they will get some kind of independence of some sort. It's not exactly termed in that way, but that they will have, they will be free from the authority of the Turks. So again, you have another layer added to this that is going to make things very difficult. And of course, a lot of pacts are made during wartime without thought of how they're going to work together afterwards, because the main thing is just to win the war, obviously. But these are going to really complicate it. Then after that, in the post-war period, in 1919, Faisal, the son of Hussein, who believes he's going to be the ruler of this Syrian empire, meets with Chaim Weizmann. And they draw up some kind of agreement that in exchange for Faisal endorsing the Balfour Declaration and agreeing to Jewish immigration into Palestine, that Weizmann will support the Arab claim to Syria. So this also adds a problem. Now, there is a codicil on that if the Arabs don't get Syria, then this is null and void. It's going to be meaningless. So for all those reasons, you have all these various discussions, some secret, most of them not, but all of them contradicting each other in some way, shape, or form. And so the pan-Islamist, the Khilafat movement, this is why it becomes so critical in the immediate post-war period, because of all these other factors now, that they have to now deal with the French, and they have to deal with the Zionists, and they have to deal with very other things as well. So they become much more organized and much more focused on this one issue, which is Turkey.
And how are the three men involved in adding or negotiating all of these complications?
It becomes a very big issue for two of them in particular, and that is Herbert Samuel and Edwin Montagu, the two cousins. Rufus Isaacs, Chaim Weizmann does meet with Rufus Isaacs and tries to get him to become a supporter of Zionism, because one of the ways in which Zionists believe that they will be able to finally get their Jewish homeland in whatever shape it will take, is from getting the support of people in power, particularly Jews in power. And they assume that they will get the support of these men. But he's met with rather a cold reception from Rufus Isaacs, because Rufus Isaacs is a man who believes that Jewish emancipation is the way forward to make anti-Semitism dissipate, and not having Eastern European Jews being immigrating into a land full of Arabs, that this doesn't make much sense to him. So he's not swayed on that. He's not swayed by Herbert Samuel, who also tries to send him books on it and various other things. So he's on the fence. He has sympathy for the people fleeing persecution. He has sympathy for people who are economically struggling, but he just doesn't feel this is the right way. The two people, though, that take this to another level is Herbert Samuel. Obviously, we've discussed how during the war, this becomes his religion almost. In place of the religion he lost during university, this becomes his burning issue. And he is courted by Chaim Weizmann, who understands that he can do a lot for the group. And he sets about talking to everybody and trying to persuade them. He has a lot of luck, obviously, with David Lloyd George and with Balfour. And he will be the principal voice in the British government on the Jewish side for Zionism. And against him will be his cousin, because Edwin Montague emerges as the ultimate anti-Zionist. He thinks that it is a movement that will absolutely destroy the position of Jews in the countries in which they live. And the fact is that for him, he's an Englishman. He's not a Palestinian or a Semite or anything else. He's an Englishman first and foremost. And this kind of attitude obviously is derided by most Zionists. But he sees Zionism as a threat personally, that it will personally affect his position and the position of Jews in Britain and elsewhere. And he also sees Zionism as a threat politically, because his whole idea, once he becomes Secretary of State, is to work on the reforms that have been already implemented in 1909 and then increase on them. So he wants to bring in more reforms, a system that is called diarchy, a federal system that will reform India's, the way that India is run, and bring in more Indians into the government, with the idea in the future that it will lead to their status as dominion part of the empire. So he sees Zionism as a threat to that, as a threat to his reforms, because it will agitate the Khilafat movement in India. It will also agitate other Muslims who are not part of that. And this will create an atmosphere that will make it very difficult for his reforms to go smoothly into place. So he sets out really to counter everything that Herbert Samuel does. He distributes anti-Zionist literature. He goes and speaks first to Asquith while he's prime minister. And then there's no point talking to David Lloyd George, because David Lloyd George is a committed Zionist. So, and he even brings up a religious argument, which is very unusual, because he's not a religious man, but he even argues that it goes against religious law, because the people are not supposed to bring about Israel again. It's not supposed to be resurrected by men, but by the Messiah. So he even brings that into the fore. When the Balfour Declaration is declared, he really is a lone voice, him and Lord Curzon, who also is against the Balfour Declaration. He's actually in India, so he's not there at the time. But He will continue his anti-Zionist stance all his life. Even when congratulating Herbert Samuel on the job he does, he still believes it was a huge error. The Balfour Declaration was a huge error, and believes that it was a bad thing for India and a bad thing for Jews, including him personally.
Hmm. Thank you for taking us through that. I'd love to kind of pick up on something you briefly mentioned, sort of the reactions, not just that they had to each other. That's fascinating, but kind of also what reactions others had to them. So, for example, you know, Samuel's being such a Zionist and then having the appointment of High Commissioner of Palestine, an issue that has a lot of relevance for Zionism. How did these kind of their known Jewish identities, the fact of the positions they had, the government roles that they had, as well as their positions around Zionism, how did people react to this? How did Jewish communities think about it? How did the press think about it? Did it have any actual impact on like what they did in their jobs?
It did and it didn't. There was, right from the beginning, early on, there was always discussions about Jews in politics, and also other people's connections to them. So there was suspicion about David Lloyd George and his connection to certain Jews, conspiratorial ideas that somehow he was beholden to them and this kind of thing. So certainly when they get, the higher up they get, the more that this is talked about. If we take one by one, when Edwin Montagu becomes Secretary of State for India, there is a big discussion about whether or not this is appropriate, whether he's the right person for the job. And even people who like him and support him still wonder whether or not it's a good idea to put a Jew in such a position. So we do have that, and we have it in the newspapers as well. Most newspapers were very supportive, and especially the Indian press was very supportive. But there were certain elements, there were certain places that were not. So, for example, The Spectator and The Morning Post in particular do say, well, you know, this is not appropriate. This is not appropriate to have a Jew in such a position, such an important position. And they will, at every corner, every time something goes wrong in India, relate it in some way to his Jewishness. So they will talk about his Oriental methods. And in fact, there's quite a few Punch cartoons which depict him as an Oriental or speaking Yiddish and this kind of thing, because this was the image of Jews. So you do have some, on the one hand, some people, and it's certainly not the majority, who do talk about it as being a bad decision. They do hark back to certain scandals, and this is mainly for Rufus Isaacs and Herbert Samuel, but they do talk about certain scandals that make them consider Jews to be untrustworthy. And then, of course, with Zionism, the fear is, well, who are they really talking for? Are they talking for the British Empire? Are they talking for this Jewish nation? You know, can we really trust Jews to be loyal to the empire? And this goes back, and of course, it's exacerbated by Zionists who are telling people, if you are a Jew, you're not really English, you're not really French, you're not really German, because you can never be. You are a Jew, so you can never be truly that. So that Zionist argument is taken up and internalized against men who are not like that at all, who absolutely are Englishmen. So with Edwin Montagu, it does exacerbate as the situation in India gets out of control, and as the nationalism increases, as the Khilafat movement becomes more powerful, as as Gandhi emerges as a potent force in India, the people who have a tendency towards linking his Jewishness with his inability to handle affairs, another anti-Semitic connection that goes back a long time, that Jews are unable to rule, this kind of talk about his Oriental methods, about his lack of ability, about his all relate somehow to his Jewishness. In the case of Rufus Isaacs, he becomes involved early in his career, well, mid in his career, with the Marconi scandal, as does Herbert Samuel. And so at the time, this is considered, I mean, he is criticized from many quarters as somebody who is the Lord Chief Justice doing something that is considered so underhand, that this is not the sign of a moral man or a just man. And so he is criticized by people like Rudyard Kipling and G.K. Chesterton and many other people. And this is something that just doesn't go away. So even when he's Viceroy of India, which is welcomed by most people, there are certain elements who consider it not right to put a Jew in a position so exalted. So again, it's usually the same two newspapers. It's the Morning Post, and the Journal Spectator, who question this, that at a time when perhaps a firmer hand is needed in India because of all the tumult that's there at the time, that maybe it's a mistake. And they go further. It's not only a mistake. They say it's an absolute disaster. It's an imperial disaster. And then go further even still to wonder why. And in fact, Henry Ford's Dearborn Independent raises this kind of conspiracy talk by saying, you know, why are there suddenly so many Jews in these positions, these important positions? Who's putting them there? And why are they putting them there? And what are they going to do? And there's this idea, again, because of the Zionist connection, there's this idea that somehow they're not there because of their ability, their skill, the fact that they have had many jobs before and they're considered the right person for the job, but because they're being placed there for other reasons. And it's not there for the British policy, it's not there for the British Empire, but for some kind of Jewish interest. And of course, this is built on the growth, the quite explosive growth of Zionism, which goes from a fairly small, inconsequential movement to, during the war, a very strong movement with a lot of very powerful people backing it. So this adds to it. In conjunction with that, you have the appearance just after the war of the English translation of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which, being based on a conspiracy theory that Jews want to control the world, to the people who believe this kind of thing, it seems to be coming true all of a sudden in the shape of these men. You've got Ed Montagu in London directing Indian affairs. You've got now the Viceroy being Jewish, and then Herbert Samuel over in Palestine. And so a lot of them think that this is some kind of conspiracy, and it's detrimental not only to the empire, but it's detrimental to the Muslims, because all of this seems to be affecting the Muslims more than anyone else. So when Herbert Samuel goes in, so you do have some discussion, quite very vigorous discussion, that says that Rufus Isaacs is not the right type of man. There's also fears that the Anglo-Indian community won't accept him. They didn't like Edwin Montagu, and they fear that they won't accept him for two reasons. One, that he's a Jew, and also the fact that because they don't like Edwin Montagu, they're going to kind of lump him in with him. And the second is because he is middle class, his father being a fruit merchant. So for snobbish reasons as well, that they won't accept him. As it turns out, he does very well there. Then, of course, when Herbert Samuel gets the position, this is just to the conspiracy theorists and to the people who are legitimately concerned, because there are some people who do have concerns that maybe it's not a good idea to put somebody who is not only a Jew but a Zionist in charge of an area that's being contested, and being contested not only by Arabs, not only by Palestinian Arabs, but also by Arabs elsewhere, and also by Muslims elsewhere, and by the Khilafat movement. So you've got a lot of people protesting against this. And so there's a lot of talk about why is he doing this. So even people who like Herbert Samuel and think he will be good in the job, and even people who don't have time for conspiracy theories, still think it's a mistake and think that it's not the best thing to do. So you have a division. There are, you know, he has his supporters. And so a lot of people are thinking, look, he's a fair-minded man. He will do a good job and this will be all turn out fine. But there is, in the case of all three men, there are a lot of concerns, and they all, because they all come together and because the positions all seem to come at the same time. Edwin Montague is a little bit earlier, but he's in position when the other two go into their posts. So building on all these other things that are going on with the Zionist movement, with the Arab movements, with the Muslim movements, it is the perfect storm to create these conspiracy theories or even just the legitimate concerns about all three of them.
So given that the three of them are kind of lumped together in these ways, how does that go? Do they leave their imperial positions at the same time? Do they do the same things afterwards? Like, how does that side of things look?
No, they don't leave at the same time. What happens with Edwin Montague is that he has always been very passionate about justice for Turkey, because again, like with Zionism, it affects his desire to put his reforms into place. So he believes that the Turks should get a very fair peace and that it should be left intact and the Sultan should be left intact. So he sides on, he's with that, because that will bring peace to India, with the Khilafat movement being satisfied and other Muslims as well who are concerned about the Jewish immigration into the area. So he's a big proponent for keeping the Ottoman Empire intact. So this has been a bone of contention between him and David Lloyd George. David Lloyd George is very anti-Turk, and that's based on the experience of the Armenians with the Turks, and also just his personal connection with the Greek prime minister, and a vehement dislike of the Turks. So this puts him at odds with his prime minister and with various other people as well. So he keeps, once the Treaty of Sèvres comes into place, which is quite harsh in putting into place these mandates and carving up the Ottoman Empire into mandates, Edwin Montague continues his battle against it in order to try and get it overturned and try and get a better deal for the Turks. And again, yes, this is motivated by his concern over India. So he and Rufus Isaacs, Lord Reading, decide to write a telegram in which they put forward this viewpoint that Turkey should have a fairer peace, and that they state their viewpoint on this. And Edwin Montague goes away, and he that's it. But Rufus Isaac sends the telegram. Now, such a telegram, by protocol, should have been vetted by the cabinet. So the cabinet is up in arms. Edwin Montague is not in a stable position as it is, because India is descending somewhat into chaos politically. and is quite unstable. And so he has a lot of people baying for his blood as it is and want him out of there. And this gives them the perfect opportunity because he's gone against cabinet protocol. It's a very reckless decision. And even his friends can't understand it. They're asking, why on earth would you do this? You know that people want you out of this. Why on earth would you give them this on a platter? So he is forced to resign in 1922, something that really breaks his heart because this has been his life work, that he wanted to see these reforms go into place in India. He began to actually change his mind on this and began to think that maybe the reforms were too weak, that maybe India should just have been given dominion status straight away. Instead of having this gradual approach, it should have just been made like Australia and Canada and just have dominion status straight away. So he is absolutely heartbroken because he now knows that the chances of doing the reforms at all are going to be less or almost nil. So he is then out of politics. And like most people out of politics like this, they take up positions on as board members. And then he goes on a trip to Brazil as a finance research committee. And when he comes back, he falls ill. And because he was known to be somewhat of a hypochondriac throughout his whole life, he always talked about his death. He was a bit dramatic in that sense that a lot of people didn't pay much attention. But eventually it was found that he did have blood poisoning. And he died in 1924 at the age of 45. Now, after he is forced out of India, the question then in the newspapers and elsewhere is what's to become of Rufus Isaacs, what's become of Lord Reading as viceroy, because he was equally, if not more, to blame. He's the one who sent the telegram. It's in his name. So why is he allowed to stay on when Montagu's forced out? But David Lloyd George decides not to force him out. They perhaps have more of a personal connection. Again, conspiracy theories go into overdrive, suggesting that maybe Rufus Isaacs has something on David Lloyd George. It's suspicious why he is so beholden to him. But they have a better connection. So he stays on and he's there until 1926, I believe. And then he returns, and like Edwin Montagu, he goes and takes various positions on various boards. He keeps an interest in India, and then he dies in the 1930s, at the age of early 70s. Herbert Samuel lives the longest. He has a very long life. He leaves 11 months before Reading leaves India, and he feels he's done a good job. Problem with Samuel, and this was the general feeling, because he was a Jew, because he was a Zionist, he was so intent on being fair that sometimes he made bad decisions according to a lot of people. He was acutely aware that the Arabs in Palestine saw him as pro-Jewish and pro-Zionist, but he was also aware that the Zionists didn't like him either because they thought he wasn't doing enough. And every time he did something that favored the Arabs, the Zionists would complain. So he, in the end, satisfied no one. And it was with a sigh of relief amongst some people when he left, because they thought, well, now we'll get somebody who really is objective and who doesn't always have to think, oh, what will the Arabs think? So his tenure in Palestine, pretty uneventful, except for the fact that he did create the Supreme Muslim Council under the aegis of al-Husseini. But he was perhaps the wrong choice for that very reason, that he was always going to be seen by both sides as ineffectual, as not doing the right thing. So he leaves, and he continues to have an interest in Palestine and a belief in the Balfour Declaration, what it set out to do. So all his life, he really believed that there could be some kind of community of Jews and Arabs that would come together and benefit from each other, that if Jewish entrepreneurs from elsewhere brought in money and could help the land in that way, the Arabs would benefit too, and that they could live together. And he really believed that, and that was what the Balfour Declaration basically was hoping. But he becomes disillusioned, because obviously this is not the way things turn out. The brief moment of binationalism comes and goes very quickly, and he is left very disillusioned with the whole idea of what's going on in Palestine. He lives on till his 90, I believe he's 92 when he dies in 1960s. He does become the leader of the Liberal Party after David Lloyd George. So he has a very long, eventful life. But I'd say that the pinnacle, being the High Commissioner of Palestine, ended up not really doing anything for either side. So it really probably would have been best if he hadn't accepted that position. So that was the end of the three. It was a short period, but it was a time that had a lot of possibilities of what they could do and what could have happened in India, how it could have gone, what could have happened in Palestine but didn't. And much of that was down to the fact that perhaps of their Jewishness, and the rise of Zionism and the rise of these other movements and all these things coming together, that made their job extremely difficult. It's a difficult job anyway, but made their particular job, the fact that they're all three Jews in the same place at the same time, made their job even harder.
No, absolutely. And thank you for taking us through kind of it would be very easy to go, wow, this is such a tangled ball of yarn, there's no possible way to make sense of it. But helping us pick through all the different strands and take us back to this moment where so many things came together and were being debated and discussed, given kind of where we're at now, it's often easy to forget kind of that it wasn't all written in stone at one point. So thank you so much for kind of taking us back in time and explaining what happened. If I can ask just a final question, you started us off with a really interesting kind of investigation into how you came into this project, how you came back into this project. And so I'm curious what you might be working on now that this book is done.
Well, funnily enough, I'm taking a break from academic work, and I'm actually writing my first novel. So it will be a complete change for me. It is a historical novel, so I do get to do research still, so that pleases me. But we'll see. I'm in the middle of it right now, so we'll see how that goes.
Well, that's exciting. Good luck with that, trying a new thing there. But while you are working on it, of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, again, titled British Jews and Imperial Service, Nationalism, Pan-Islamism and Zionism in Mandate Palestine and Colonial India, published by Bloomsbury. Stephanie, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.